they looked. Hideki slid around to the back side of the cave so the soldiers had to turn away from them to see him.
"What's the message?" one of the soldiers asked.
"Yes, the message," Hideki said.
He hadn't thought that far ahead yet. Ideas swarmed in his mind like flies, but none of them landed. Behind the soldiers, one of the children slipped in the mud and fell, and Kimiko stopped to help him up.
"The Yamato," Hideki said. "The big battleship is coming to save us."
"What? We heard it was sunk,"
one of the soldiers said.
"No, that was just a rumor started by the high command to fool the Americans. The Yamato is still floating and will soon chase the American armada away so more reinforcements can land."
It might have been a tall tale, but it was one the two soldiers desperately wanted to believe. They laughed and clapped each other on the shoulders. As life came back into their faces, Hideki saw how young they were under those beards, barely older than he was. Behind the soldiers, Kimiko and the others were still visible, climbing a long, low hill.
"Where are you from?"
Hideki asked, trying to stall for time.
"Hiroshima," one of the boys said. "I was going to go to university to study chemistry, but then I was drafted into the army."
"I'm from Iwaki,"
the other boy said.
"My father and I were fishermen before the Navy confiscated our boat. Then he and I were both drafted. He's in Korea now."
The two soldiers were quiet for a moment, remembering the people they used to be. Their lives got interrupted by the war just like mine, Hideki realized. It was easy to think of the soldiers as the ones doing the interrupting, as the people who had come to disrupt the peace of Okinawa. But neither of these boys had volunteered for this. They both had things they'd been doing, families they longed to see again, plans for the future. All that had been taken away from them, too.
"Do you have any food in that pack, Private?"
one of the soldiers asked. Hideki's heart fluttered at the offer of a perfect new distraction, until he remembered he and the others had already eaten everything he had.
"I'm sorry, I don't have food," he told them, "but I do have cigarettes."
The look on the soldiers' faces told Hideki he was their new best friend. Hideki took his time emptying his pack to look for the cigarettes, and stole a quick glance outside. Kimiko helped the last of the children over the hill, and they disappeared into the darkness. Hideki smiled with relief and relaxed. He didn't have to keep the soldiers' attention any longer, and his thoughts turned to how quickly now he could get away and rejoin Kimiko.
"What's this?"
one of the soldiers asked. Hideki had taken the oilskin pouch of photographs out to find the cigarettes, and one of the soldiers had picked it up and was looking inside.
"Oh, that's pictures,"
Hideki said, though the soldiers could clearly see that's what they were. Pictures of dead soldiers and their families, he thought, but he couldn't say that. The soldiers lit cigarettes and flipped through the pictures, studying the faces and places. With each image of their long-lost home, the mood in the bunker became more and more melancholy.
"Why do you have all these?"
one of the soldiers asked. Hideki couldn't explain Mabui, couldn't explain Rei, not here, not now. He said instead,
"The American ones were in a pack I took from a soldier after he was dead. After I killed him, the others soldiers gave to me for safekeeping."
The soldiers might have understood that the men who gave Hideki the photos were all dead now, but they accepted the little white lie. The two young men smoked their cigarettes and thought of home, and Hideki sat awkwardly, itching to get his pictures back and leave.
"I should get back to headquarters," Hideki said at last.
The soldiers nodded and handed him back the pictures.
"Hey, can I give you a picture too?"
one of them said. He pulled a wrinkled, water-stained photo from his jacket pocket. He hesitated, reluctant to let it go, then handed it to Hideki.
"It's me and my mother, back in Iwaki," he said. "For safekeeping, like the others. You know, in case the Yamato doesn't come in time for us."
"Me too,"
the other soldier said. He gave Hideki a picture of him and his sweetheart, a pretty young woman who lived in Hiroshima. They knew, Hideki realized. They knew the Yamato was a lie. If not his lie, then somebody else's. That the dream of victory was just that, a dream. The reality was, they were all going to die here on Okinawa, and soon. And Hideki and his sister and the children were going to die with them if they couldn't get past the American army next. Lion dogs. Hideki hadn't walked too far when he found Kimiko, Masako, and the children, all hiding behind an exploded Japanese truck. To their left, Hideki could hear the roar of the sea. To their right, a steep rock cliff rose like teeth from the ground.
"Sorry you had to wait for me," Hideki said. "We didn't have a choice,"
Masako said. She nodded for Hideki to follow her, and together the two of them crawled through the mud to a bend in the road. Just beyond them was an American camp. Someone, either the Americans or the Japanese before them, had cut down trees so that they fell across the road, and the soldiers guarding the camp stood behind the log barricade, facing south. Behind them, Hideki could see other soldiers at a cook fire they'd sheltered from the rain. Hideki made a frame with his fingers. There were at least 10 American soldiers, including 2 guards, so close Hideki could hit them with a rock. Or a grenade. The American camp couldn't have been more than a few dozen meters from the Japanese machine gun nest Hideki had just left. It was almost dawn, and as soon as the sun rose, these American soldiers would advance south and run right into the young Japanese soldiers. They would fight, and the Americans would win. They always won, eventually. But in the meantime, Hideki and the others would be caught in the crossfire. They had to get past the Americans before that happened. Hideki nodded for Masako to turn around, and together they returned to where Kimiko and the children waited.
"Well?" Kimiko asked. "The Americans are taking up the whole road," Hideki explained. "There's no way to sneak by without them seeing us. What if we went out in the water and swam around them?" Kimiko suggested.
Hideki shook his head.
"If they see us in the water, they'll think we're a Japanese attack force and start shooting at us." "Do you still have that grenade?" Masako asked. "Yes," Hideki said, "but I can't kill them all with one grenade. There's too many of them." "We don't have to kill them all," Masako said, "just a few of them. We throw it from the ocean side to make them think the Japanese army is attacking from the beach. While they're shooting at shadows, we run behind them, along the road. Then we're safe."
Hideki pulled the grenade out of his pocket, weighing it in his hand as he walked off by himself. Masako's plan was dangerous, but it could work. He'd seen the Americans when they were angry. They were like shisa, lion dogs. When they got something in their teeth, they shook it until it was dead. They would destroy the beach with machine guns and mortars and grenades, and then go down there with rifles and bayonets to make sure there wasn't anyone left. That's when Hideki and the others could slip on by. Kimiko joined Hideki, leaving Masako with the children.
"What are you thinking, Hideki?"
his sister asked him quietly. Hideki tried to put it into words, the way he hadn't been able to when Masako wanted him to use the grenade on the mother of all bombs, the way he'd felt when he decided not to use his grenade on the Japanese soldiers in the machine gun nest.
"I'm thinking that this isn't our fight," Hideki told her. "It's not between Okinawa and America, or Okinawa and Japan. It's between America and Japan. Why can't we just let them duke it out?" "Because Okinawa is caught in the middle, just like we are," Kimiko said. "All this time, people kept telling me this is your island. You should be defending it," Hideki said. "But I wasn't defending it. I was fighting for somebody else's side while they both destroyed my home. And I'm tired of it. I want to be on Okinawa's side for once. So use the grenade on the Americans to save some Okinawans," Kimiko told him.
Kimiko had a point. If he used the grenade here and now, he could lead them all to safety. Masako, the children, Kimiko. That's what he'd really promised his father after all, wasn't it? Not just to find his sister, but to keep what was left of his family together. To live. And sometimes you had to fight to live. Maybe he needed to fight to save Okinawa, too. The thought of fighting made Hideki remember all the awful things he'd seen each side do to each other. The awful things both sides had done to Okinawans in the name of war.
"No," Hideki said. "No, if we attack them, we're their enemy. When they're not under attack, when they're not afraid, the Americans are human beings. They actually helped me, gave me medicine, sewed up my head. It's the same with the Japanese. the photographer, my principal. My teachers, they were nice to me before the Americans came. That machine gun nest back there, it didn't have two monsters in it. It had two human beings. But if I threw this grenade at them, they would have turned into monsters, just like these Americans. They'll become monsters that breathe fire and bullets. They're not at war with Okinawa. They're at war with Japan. But if I throw this grenade at them, they'll be at war with Okinawa too. Okinawa is Japan, Kimiko said. Are we? Hideki asked.
Kimiko was quiet for a time, then said,
We have to do something, Hideki.
Hideki stared at the grenade in his hand. If he didn't use his last grenade here and now, when would he ever use it? And that's when he knew what he had to do. Naked. To the east, the black night sky was beginning to turn blue over the high, jagged ridge.
It's almost dawn, Hideki said. As soon as the sun's up, we'll surrender.
Surrender?
Masako said. She'd come to see what he and Kimiko were talking about.
We can't surrender to the Americans. They'll kill us.
Not if we don't make them afraid, Hideki said.
He remembered the how to surrender leaflets that had fallen on him the day after the Americans had first landed. How long ago that seemed now. What had the papers said? Stay away from the Japanese army. Wear white. Make it clear you were surrendering, and not a threat. He also remembered the Japanese using Okinawans as human shields, and how the Americans had gunned down Okinawans who were no threat at all because they were afraid there were explosives, or Japanese soldiers hidden under their kimonos. Hideki and the others didn't have anything white to wear. All their clothes were muddy brown. So how would they convince the Americans they were harmless? Hideki had felt powerless many times in his life, especially since the Americans had landed. But one moment stood out among them all. Hideki remembered being naked on the battlefield, shivering in the rain as he peeled layer after layer of maggot-filled, bloody clothes off his body. Stripped down until there was nothing left of him. A ghost. He'd felt so exposed, so unprotected. It was horrifying. That was how they had to be now, if they wanted to survive.
We'll go naked, Hideki said.
What?
Masako said.
It's the only way, Hideki told them. At least down to our underclothes. We have to be as harmless as possible. As long as we don't make them scared, we'll be all right. But if anybody does anything to make them angry or afraid...
Hideki didn't have to tell them what they would do if that happened.
Hideki, are you sure about this?
Kimiko asked him. The sky behind the sawtooth ridge to the east turned orange. The sun was almost up.
Tell the kids to take their clothes off, Hideki said. It's time.
Hideki stepped away from the others and pulled off Ray's pack. The only thing he took out from it was the oilskin envelope with the photographs. Hideki removed his Japanese army jacket and pants and slid the waterproof pouch down the back of his underpants, the only piece of clothing he still wore. Hideki put his helmet upside down in the mud and then folded his clothes and nestled them neatly inside it. On the very top, he placed his grenade, the one the IJA had given him to kill himself with. Hideki had finally understood this is what he had to do with his last grenade. If he took it with him now, it would kill him. To live, Hideki had to leave his only weapon behind. Surrender. Hideki felt like he was about to brave the gauntlet back at school, but this gauntlet was deadly serious. How had he ever been afraid of Yoshio and his friends when there were things that were far scarier in the world? The sun was just over the crest of the ridge when Hideki, Kimiko, and Masako walked around the bend, followed by eight small children. All of them wore nothing but their underclothes. For Hideki and the other boys, that meant once white, now gray shorts. The girls wore gray underpants with another piece of gray cloth tied tight around the chest for Kimiko and Masako. The younger children were more comfortable with their nakedness, but Hideki knew how Kimiko and Masako and the older children must be feeling. Defenseless, exposed, vulnerable. Hopefully the Americans would see them the same way. The soldiers stood behind the barricade of fallen trees. Hideki and the others had just come within sight of the first American sentries when the clouds above them parted, and for the first time in a solid month, the rain stopped. It was like someone had suddenly dammed up a river. Hideki stopped and blinked as actual sunlight came streaming through, warm on his naked skin. The children all stopped in their tracks, forgetting for a moment they were walking into a viper's nest. It distracted the soldiers on guard, too. For a long moment, everyone on the road and in the camp stopped and looked up at the sun, like none of them had ever imagined living to see it again. And then one of the soldiers cried out and pointed at the children, and the moment was broken. The two guards at the perimeter of the camp aimed their rifles at them and shouted things Hideki didn't understand. Hideki's hand instinctively went for his grenade, but of course it wasn't there. He felt a twinge of panic at leaving his only protection behind. But no, if he had a grenade in his hand right now, he would already be dead. Within seconds, more soldiers had run to take up positions behind the fallen logs that ringed their camp. An entire squad pointed their guns straight at Hideki and the others. One of the smaller boys whimpered and tried to turn around, but Kimiko took his hand and comforted him. Hideki took a step forward, and the American soldiers erupted with unintelligible, angry shouts. Hideki's heart beat so hard he thought it would bust out of his chest. What had he done? How would they survive this? If the American soldiers fired at them now, they were helpless. They would all be dead. They didn't even speak the same language. One of the soldiers barked at them again in English, but no one understood it. Hideki took another step forward. The Americans shouted again, and they squinted down the barrels of their rifles. Hideki could just imagine their fingers tightening around the triggers, squeezing. This wasn't going at all like it had when he'd surrendered with the Miyagi family. The Americans were too on edge now. The sunlight had startled everyone, made it look like Hideki and the others had appeared out of nowhere. Hideki felt a bead of sweat trickle down his forehead and hit his bare chest. Beside him, one of the little girls started to cry.
"It's going to be all right,"
Hideki told the children with a courage he didn't feel. One of the soldiers barked louder than all the others, and Hideki trembled as the biggest man he'd ever seen pushed his way to the front of the soldiers. He was more bear than man, and he carried a big rifle that was as long as Hideki was tall. His face was dark with stubble, and Hideki realized with a start that one of his ears was completely gone, replaced by a scarred red crater the size and shape of a coconut crab. Hideki fought the urge to take a step back, and he stood his ground.
"Do not move,"
the big bear man said. The intonation was all wrong, but Hideki thought he understood it. The American was speaking Japanese. Hideki glanced around Masako and his sister, and they shared in his amazement and relief. Quickly, Kimiko and Masako made sure the children understood.
"Okay, okay,"
Hideki said, repeating something he'd heard the Americans say at the field hospital where he was treated.
"Do not be tricks," the bear man said.
"We surrender,"
Hideki said, hoping the bear man understood. He pronounced the Japanese word more slowly.
"Surrender."
The big bear man glanced around at the other soldiers, and they grunted slowly at each other. Hideki guessed they were debating what he had said. Hideki turned his palms up to show them he wasn't carrying a weapon and took a step forward.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa,"
the soldiers yelled, and the rifles that had dipped came clacking back up at him.
"Don't shoot," Hideki pleaded. "Don't shoot."
"Raise your hands," the bear man growled. "Obey, or I fire."
Hideki quickly put his hands up and urged the others to do the same. All around him, Kimiko, Masako, and the children did as they were told and threw their hands up as high as they could go. There. There was no way the Americans could see them as a threat now. They were naked, weaponless, obedient.
Pakow!
A single shot rang out, the sound booming off the steep ridge wall to their right, and Hideki flinched. Before the last echo had faded away, the little boy beside him, Kazuo, the one who'd been the last to squeeze through past the bomb before Hideki, the one he'd guarded with his life, fell face forward into the mud. Rise up. The children screamed. Kimiko cried out. Hideki dropped into the mud next to the boy, his hands over his head, and the others did the same.
Kazuo! Kazuo, are you all right?
Hideki shouted. Kazuo cried in pain, but he was alive. He was alive, but the Americans had shot him. Tears sprang to Hideki's eyes. We're all going to die, he thought. They shot Kazuo, and we're all going to die. He wanted to get up and check on Kazuo, but he was too afraid of being shot. He kept his face down in the mud.
We did what they told us, Kimiko cried. We did exactly what they told us to do, and they still shot at us.
She didn't understand, but Hideki did. He knew now why otherwise normal men became monsters. It wasn't just when you threatened them. They became monsters when they were afraid. It didn't excuse it, but it explained it. These men had been pushed past the edge of fear. The Battle of Okinawa had done it to Japanese soldiers, to American soldiers, even to Hideki himself. He had hoped to slip past the front lines when things were calm enough for both sides to be human, but he realized now that was impossible. It was too late. They were all monsters now. Hideki squeezed his eyes shut tight and waited for more bullets. But they didn't come. What he heard instead was more shouting among the Americans. He looked up to see the big bear of a man grabbing the rifle of a smaller, younger soldier and twisting it toward the sky. The bear man roared at the young soldier, then at the other soldiers. He was angry. The young soldier must have been the one who shot the boy, and the big bear was mad at him. More soldiers shouted and argued, but the big bear man had the last word. The Americans kept their rifles trained on Hideki and the others, but they were more sheepish now. They didn't bark and snap at them like dogs, didn't squint down their rifle barrels like they were about to shoot. Hideki took a deep breath. He had to get help for Kazuo, and he and Kimiko and Masako and the others all had to get moving if they wanted to live. That shot had echoed far and wide in the early morning stillness. The Japanese soldiers had to have heard it. An infiltration squad could be here any moment, and then nothing the bear man said or did would save them. Hideki and the others would be caught in the middle of a gunfight. Slowly, fearfully, Hideki pushed himself up out of the mud and stood.
Hideki, what are you doing?
Kimiko cried. Naked, shivering, covered with mud, Hideki put his hands in the air again and stared at the big soldier. This was it. Neither of them needed to speak the same language to understand. There were only two ways this could end. Either he let Hideki and the others go by, or he killed them where they stood. A long moment passed between them, and then the bear man said something in English that sounded quiet and gentle, apologetic. He lowered his enormous rifle and nodded. Legs shaking, Hideki walked slowly, carefully, over to Kazuo, and gently lifted him out of the mud. Kazuo had been shot through the arm. There was blood, and the arm was limp like it was broken. But Kazuo would live if Hideki could get him to one of the American doctors. Kazuo buried his head in Hideki's chest, sobbing quietly.
It's going to be okay, Kazuo, Hideki whispered. I'll protect you.
Hideki knew he couldn't really protect Kazuo from being shot. He couldn't protect any of them from being shot. But he would try, at least. And he would die trying, if he had to.
Get the little ones on their feet,
Hideki told Kimiko. She stood, warily, borrowing some of Hideki's bravery.
Come on, Masako, you too,
Hideki said. Masako didn't stand up.
They shot him,
she said, staring at Kazuo's injured arm.
They'll shoot us, too.
They might, Hideki said, but there's nothing else we can do. Kimiko helped Masako up and held her hand. Kimiko took one of the children's hands as well. One by one, they took each other's hands, the last of the children clutching Hideki's arm so hard it started to go numb, forming a 10-person long chain across the road. And then they began to walk, American soldiers still pointed guns at them, and one or two of the little kids backed up a step, still afraid of what these strangers might do.
"Don't run," Hideki told the children. "Keep your eyes down. Don't do anything to make them think you're a threat."
They drew closer and closer to the Americans, to the barrels of the guns. The big bear man said something that carried a warning tone, and Hideki glanced up. But the bear man wasn't talking to the children. He was admonishing the other soldiers. Was he telling them not to shoot? A couple of them gave him angry, skeptical looks, but the bear man appeared to be the boss. Hideki put his eyes on the ground again.
"We're almost there," he told the children. "Be brave and just keep walking."
Kazuo had gone limp in his arms, either from exhaustion or shock, Hideki didn't know, but Kazuo had passed out. It was just as well. Seeing the soldiers with their guns, knowing what they could do, made Hideki's whole body quiver with fear. They were almost there. Almost there. Hideki's bare foot passed through a gap in the barricades, and he was across the line. Masako and Kimiko and the children had made it too. Hideki's breath left him, and he collapsed to his knees, sobbing. They had done it. They were through. They were safe. Hideki looked up at the big bear man with relief and gratitude and hoped he understood. And then the Japanese army found them. Over the line. A Japanese machine gun blared behind them. Choo, 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 choo. And one of the American soldiers right in front of Hideki went down. There were screams, shouts, and then Americans were shooting back. The big bear man's rifle boomed right over Hideki's head. Choo, choo, choo. Choo, 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 choo. Hideki ducked behind one of the logs in the road, shielding Kazuo with his body. His sister and Masako and all the other children dove for cover, too. They were safe from the firestorm, from the monsters at each other's throats. Bullets tore into the trees at their backs, and a grenade exploded a few yards beyond them, in the heart of the American camp. Hideki threw his hands over his head and prayed to his ancestors to see him safely through. Beside him, the big bear man dropped down to reload his enormous rifle and pull out a grenade of his own.
"Ray?"
the big soldier said, and Hideki looked up. The bear man with the missing ear was looking around like there was somebody else there whom neither of them could see. Hideki knew that feeling all too well. The big soldier looked down at Hideki and frowned. Did he recognize Ray's Mabui on Hideki? Could he? The big soldier shook off whatever it was he was feeling, pulled the pin on his grenade, and stood to throw it. Another American soldier hurried up to Hideki. This soldier had no weapon and was wearing a white armband with a red cross on it. Hideki recognized the armband as the same one the doctors at the camp had worn, and he gratefully handed off Kazuo to the man. Then Hideki followed along, crouching as he ran. Behind him, more soldiers with red crosses on their armbands pulled Kimiko and Masako and the other children away. Bullets still flew and grenades still exploded, but Hideki wasn't afraid anymore. He knew they would be all right now. In the camps, away from the battlefield, the Americans would be human again, and Hideki and Kimiko and all the other Okinawan children would get the food and water and medical attention they required. There was only one thing Hideki still needed, but for that, the Americans couldn't help him. For that, he needed a Yuta. A beginning. Hideki and Kimiko slipped away from the American refugee camp and climbed the hill up to what was left of Shuri Castle. Only 4 days had passed, but they had slept in dry beds and eaten warm food for the first time in months, and they were feeling alive again, even in the midst of so much death. The fighting had moved well beyond Shuri, and it was safe here. Now that the Japanese had been driven from the caves underneath it, and the castle itself had been destroyed, its red and gold pillars toppled and burned. Shuri Castle was nothing important anymore. Only one small part of a red wall still stood. With all the trees gone, Shuri had an even more commanding view of the island, and for a time Hideki and Kimiko just sat and stared. To the south, the highways were clogged with dirty, injured, heartbroken refugees still caught in the crossfire. Gray smoke clouds and bright orange explosions all around them marked where the Americans and Japanese still fought. To the north, where once there had been a patchwork of lush pine forests and thatched farmhouses and green rice paddies, now there was nothing but muddy, barren hills, with the nubs of shattered trees sticking up like the bristles on a spider. Out at sea, American battleships still dotted the bay, little puffs of smoke and flame erupting from their big guns as they kicked the dead horse that was Okinawa. The skies finally clear, American planes buzzed over the whole island like flies over a corpse, strafing anything that wasn't already dead. This was what their home looked like now. The battle would go on who knew how long. But once the Americans and Japanese were done with it, this was the Okinawa that Hideki and Kimiko would be left with. Hideki took off the backpack he'd borrowed from American soldiers at the camp and unzipped it. From inside, he withdrew a picture of a young Japanese man and his mother, the photo one of the soldiers in the machine gun nest had given him while Kimiko and Masako and the others slipped past. Hideki had made a frame for the picture out of shards from a broken ammunition crate. Hideki walked over to the partial red wall of the castle that still stood. With a hammer and nails he'd borrowed from an American supply tent, he hung the framed picture up on the wall. Hideki reached into the backpack for more photos and returned to the wall. He hung up the picture of a Japanese soldier and his girlfriend, and one of an American soldier and his children, and another of an American soldier and his dog. Hideki had made a frame for each of the photos out of rubble from the war, and now he hung each reverently, Americans alongside Japanese.
"So this is what you've been off doing all day, while I've been working in the medical tent?"
Kimiko asked. Hideki didn't answer, just kept hanging pictures, dozens of them.
"Why are you honoring these soldiers who killed our people and wrecked our island?"
Kimiko asked.
"I'm not," Hideki said. "Look, there aren't any soldiers here. There are brothers and fathers and sons surrounded by the people they love and the people who love them back. I'm honoring the men they were before they came to Okinawa, before they became monsters."
Kimiko looked at each of the pictures as Hideki hung it, then turned to stare at him.
"Why do you keep looking at me like that?"
Hideki asked his sister.
"You've changed," Kimiko told him. "You're more confident, braver."
Hideki snorted.
"I'm not brave."
"Yes, you are."
Kimiko pointed down to the war raging on to the south.
"You came all the way through that to find me."
"But I was scared the whole time."
His sister shook her head with exasperation.
"Hideki, when are you going to learn that being brave doesn't mean not being scared? It means overcoming your fear to do what you have to do. A real coward would have run away and never looked back. Fear isn't a weakness. Anybody who's never been afraid is a fool."
Hideki felt the world spin underneath him. What his sister said actually made sense. He'd always been ashamed of his fear, but she was right. Fear in the face of something truly terrifying, something you couldn't possibly hope to defeat, that wasn't weakness. It was natural. Logical, even. His ancestor, Shigetomo, he wasn't a soldier. He was a farmer. So why had Hideki and his other descendants expected him to fight back against trained samurai warriors? There was never any chance he could have fought the Japanese and won. It would have been suicide. "Like me and my father being sent out to fight the Americans," Hideki realized. Neither of them had the right training, the right equipment. Brave? I was so scared I pissed my pants. I was hit as I was running away. That's what his father had told him before he died. Hideki understood that fear. He'd felt it himself. All that death and destruction around him, he'd had every right to be afraid. So why should he blame Shigetomo? Or himself? There were some horrors you couldn't fight and couldn't change. The real courage was just in enduring them. Hideki felt an invisible weight lift off him, like when a Kijimuna finally got off his chest in the morning after a nightmare and he could breathe again. He felt a lightness, a release, as if he could float up into the sunlit clouds. Now that Shigatomo's cowardice had been forgiven and understood, his Mabui was gone. Hideki was sure of it. Shigatomo's spirit was free to take its place in the afterlife with the rest of Hideki's ancestors, at peace, at last. But even as his heart soared with happiness and sympathy for Shigatomo, Hideki knew there was still something wrong with him, a sickness in his spirit that had nothing to do with Shigatomo or any of his other ancestors. The last framed picture in the bag was Rei's. Rei and his father laughing together. Hideki hung it in the center of the wall, and his gaze lingered on it. I'm sorry, Rei.
Kimiko, there's something else, Hideki said.
He didn't even want to say the words, didn't want to admit the awful thing he'd done. But he had to. His sister was the only one who could help him.
Kimiko, I killed a man. An American soldier named Rei.
Kimiko didn't seem surprised.
I know, she said. I can see his Mabui on you. Can you free me from it? Yes, Kimiko said. I can help you find rest for his spirit. But that's not your biggest problem, Hideki. You've lost your own Mabui. You mean Shigatomo's spirit? Hideki said. I know. I felt it go. Shigatomo is at peace now, yes, Kimiko said. But that's not what I mean.
She turned to look him in the eyes.
Hideki, your Mabui is gone. The one you were born with. You lost it somewhere. It must have been knocked from you by something. Something violent and frightening.
Panic washed over Hideki, pulling him under like a wave. The grenade. The grenade he'd thrown at Rei had knocked Hideki's own Mabui loose, too. No wonder he'd felt so sick, so adrift. He'd lost his soul that day.
How can I restore it?
Hideki asked.
The only way is to go back to the place you lost it, and find it, and put it back. But I don't know exactly where I was when I lost it.
Hideki desperately scanned the hills all around them. Where had he been when he'd run into Rei? North of Shuri? South of Shuri? He couldn't remember. Hideki watched the battles happening in the south and wondered about all the soldiers still fighting. Had they all lost their Mabuis? Did all of them carry around an empty place inside them now, too?
Will I ever get my Mabui back?
Hideki asked.
Maybe. Maybe not,
Kimiko told him.
You may go your whole life without ever getting your spirit back.
Hideki couldn't imagine feeling this hollow all the rest of his days. At least Hideki had Rei's Mabui to borrow strength from. But that wasn't fair either. Hideki looked at Rei's smiling face in the picture. Hideki couldn't deny Rei the peace he deserved just because he selfishly wanted to keep Rei's Mabui for himself. He would do right by Rei first, make sure his spirit found peace. Then Hideki would do what he could to restore his own spirit.
That's him,
Hideki said, pointing to the picture of Rei. Kimiko got up to look at it with him.
His name is Rei. He's the soldier I killed. I didn't want to, he said, tears falling down his face. I only killed him because I was scared.
Kimiko hugged him, and Hideki let himself be hugged.
You're still lucky in a way, Kimiko said.
Hideki sniffed back his tears.
Lucky?
He said. Kimiko nodded slowly. She was gazing out over the southern part of the island again, over the blasted hillsides and shattered trees.
You see only one ghost, but me. I see them all, she said. The Americans, the Japanese, the Okinawans. All the spirits ripped so violently from this world. We'll spend the rest of our lives trying to bring them peace, and still, we won't be able to heal them all. The sins of their Mabuis, in the sins against their Mabuis, they will leave a scar on this place for generations to come.
Kimiko paused.
Their ghosts will haunt us forever. This is the end, Hideki.
Hideki made a rectangle with his fingers, framing a picture of Okinawa. But this time he didn't see the blasted gray landscape of the present, or the simple green fields and red and white villages of the past. Instead, he saw the future. Tall buildings touching the clouds, buses and cars crowding the streets, fishing boats and passenger ships trolling the aquamarine sea. The trees were back too, and the fields, green and purple and pink. Shuri Castle, rebuilt, stood bright red against the high blue sky. This was Okinawa, alive again, and stronger than ever before. And there in the corner, framed perfectly in the foreground, was his sister, Kimiko. It would take work, but together, he and Kimiko and all the others who'd survived would restore the spirit of Okinawa. They would mourn their dead, reconnect with their ancestors, and build a new future for themselves.
No, Hideki said. This isn't the end, Kimiko. It's a beginning.
This is Todd Haberkorn. We hope that you have enjoyed this production of Grenade by Alan Gratz. Hideki's story was read by Todd Haberkorn. Ray's story was read by Andrew Iden. This program was produced at Dion Audio and directed by Adrice Wardell. Executive producer, Paul R. Gagne. Editing by Kyle Verville and mastering by Jeremy Coches. Print edition published by Scholastic Press, an imprint of Scholastic Inc. Text copyright 2018 by Alan Gratz. Production copyright 2018 by Scholastic Inc. All rights reserved.
Hi, I'm Alan Gratz, the author of Grenade. Author's note. Throughout this book, American characters use the word Jap, short for Japanese, to refer to Japanese people. While the use of this term was common among soldiers and the American public during World War II, calling someone a Jap is offensive and disrespectful. I use this word in my book for historical accuracy, but it's a word you should never use. In Japan, as in other places in Asia, people list their family name first, then their given name. Thus, Hideki Kaneshiro would actually be known as Kaneshiro Hideki. To avoid confusion among American readers, I reversed the order of Japanese names in this book to follow Western naming conventions. The Battle of Okinawa began on April 1, 1945, and lasted 83 days, ending on June 22, 1945. It was the last battle of World War II and the bloodiest of the Pacific War. The Americans brought nearly 1,500 ships and more than 500,000 men to invade an island defended by a combined Japanese and Okinawan force one-fifth that size. At the beginning of the battle, the population of Okinawa was just an estimated 450,000 people. Just before the fighting began, the Japanese army encouraged civilians to relocate to northern parts of the island or to evacuate completely. But it was too little too late. The Tsushima Maru, a Japanese transport ship, left Naha Harbor in August of 1944, filled with Okinawan refugees bound for mainland Japan. But because the Japanese used the same ships to deliver troops and weapons to Okinawa as they did to evacuate refugees, U.S. submarines couldn't know if a Japanese ship was filled with soldiers or civilians. The Tsushima Maru was sunk by the USS Bofin shortly after the Japanese ship left port, killing 1,375 Okinawan refugees, including 777 children. Refugee transports were soon abandoned, leaving around 300,000 Okinawans still in harm's way. The Imperial Japanese Army knew they were never going to hold on to Okinawa, and before the Americans arrived, the most elite Japanese troops were withdrawn to prepare for what everyone assumed would be the eventual invasion of mainland Japan. To bolster their troops on Okinawa, the IJA conscripted 110,000 Okinawans into the army, about one-fourth of the island's entire population. Of that number, around 2,300 were students drafted from Okinawa's middle and high schools. Boys over the age of 14 were first used to dig caves and build airfields. Then, as the conflict drew closer, they were drafted into the Blood and Iron Student Corps, or the Signal Corps of IJA infantry and artillery units. Girls were conscripted into Student Medical Corps and put to work as nurses in IJA hospitals and command posts. Neither group was well-trained or well-organized, and almost half the young people forced to serve in the Japanese Army died in the battle. The Imperial Japanese Army fought a war of attrition on Okinawa, trying to wear down the U.S. forces little by little as they advanced south. The U.S. 10th Army moved forward an average of 133 bloody yards a day for the first 2 months of the battle, little more than the length of a football field. GIs and Marines would fight for days to take a hill, only to find that at the last minute, the Japanese Army had abandoned the hill and withdrawn to fortify the next one. The U.S. Army conquest of Kakazu Ridge, two small hills linked by a saddle in between them, took more than 2 weeks and cost the lives of hundreds of Americans and thousands of Japanese. Throughout the battle, innocent Okinawan civilians suffered and died. Japanese soldiers often ejected them from the safety of tombs and caves or forced them at gunpoint to go out for food or water during bombings. The IJA used Okinawans as human shields, strapped explosives to Okinawans, and through propaganda and outright commands, convinced Okinawans to commit mass suicide rather than be captured. While some American soldiers tried to be conscientious about the differences between Okinawan civilians and Japanese soldiers, many more found it safer to throw grenades into caves or shoot machine guns through the wooden walls of houses, killing anyone inside, rather than risk their lives by investigating first. Thousands more Okinawans were killed by American battleships and planes as refugees fled south with the retreating Imperial Japanese Army in what has become known as the Typhoon of Steel. Approximately one-fourth to one-third of the island's entire population died in the battle, including almost every Okinawan male over the age of 18. The Imperial Japanese Army never surrendered, retreating all the way to the southern tip of the island and finally committing suicide when there was nowhere left to run. By the battle's end, 12,274 American soldiers and 110,000 Japanese soldiers were dead. The brutal fighting on Okinawa and the Japanese commitment to fighting to the last man on what they saw as Japanese soil made American soldiers and commanders alike believe that a full-scale invasion of mainland Japan would cost the lives of a million Americans and every last Japanese soldier and citizen. Though there is no direct proof, many military historians now believe that the lessons learned at the Battle of Okinawa were a direct factor in the United States' decision to drop atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki 2 months later, which prompted Japan's unconditional surrender. The United States occupied Okinawa after the war, finally returning control of it to Japan in 1972. But American military bases remain on Okinawa even today. An important part of America's strategic defenses in the Far East, Okinawa is home to 32 U.S. military installations, which take up almost 20% of the island. The American presence is very controversial among Okinawans. In 2012, the United States agreed to reduce the number of U.S. military personnel on the island, but the bases and ships and soldiers remain. So too do thousands of bombs. According to Okinawa's Fire and Disaster Prevention Unit, several million shells and bombs were dropped on Okinawa by both sides during the battle, and an estimated 5% of them did not explode on impact. Many of them sank into the mud and muck and remained there. From the end of the war until 1981, more than 6,000 tons of unexploded ordnance was discovered and disposed of, and more are found every year. 20 hand grenades and 5-inch shells were found in a public park in Yuriso, and an inspection of a new site for a high school in Kadena uncovered 100 rounds of armor-piercing anti-tank shells and 19 hand grenades and naval shells. Officials estimate it may take another 60 or 70 years to clear Okinawa of all the remaining unexploded ordnance, if ever. Many of the family tombs destroyed in the Battle of Okinawa were never rebuilt or were replaced by smaller burial chambers. But Okinawa as a whole has largely recovered and been restored in the decades since the end of World War II, becoming the bright, beautiful vision Hideki sees at the end. The capital city of Naha, which was completely destroyed by American bombs during the war, is a modern, shining metropolis of nearly 350,000 people. Kakazu Ridge is surrounded by apartment buildings. White Beach, where Ray and company landed on Loveday, is now one of the top-rated tourist beaches in the Pacific. Shuri Castle was rebuilt in 1992, and in 2000 was designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Okinawa is a paradise once more, and its people are among the longest lived on Earth. At the southern tip of the island, at the site of the last fighting in the Battle of Okinawa and all of World War II, stands a monument called the Cornerstone of Peace. Dedicated on the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Okinawa, the Cornerstone of Peace lists the names of every single person who died during the Battle of Okinawa or because of it, Japanese and American and Okinawan, soldier and civilian alike. It is a memorial not to war, but to peace. Not to victors, but to victims. Like Hideki's wall of photographs, it honors the men and women and children listed there not as soldiers or conscripts or refugees, but as the people they were before war swept them away. New names are added every year. Acknowledgements. Thank you to my amazing editor, Amy Friedman, and to publisher David Levithan for their continuing faith and support. Huge thanks as well to the experts who read Grenade and helped me get my facts right, including Trent Reedy, Mitsuyo Sato, and Mieko Mashiro. Any mistakes that remain are my own. Thank you to my copy editor, Bonnie Cutler, and my proofreader, Susan Hom, for making me look like I know what I'm doing. And once again, I owe a huge debt of gratitude to everyone who works behind the scenes at Scholastic to make my books such a success. Ellie Berger, president of Trade Publishing. Tracy Van Stratton and Crystal McCoy in publicity. Mindy Stockfield, Rachel Feld, and Vaishali Nayak in marketing. Lizette Serrano, Emily Heddleston, Michael Strauss, Matthew Poulter, and Danielle Yaddo in library and school marketing and conventions. Amy's assistant, Olivia Valcarce, Melissa Shermer, Cheryl Weissman, Leslie Gerich, Catherine Sisko, Joanne Mojica, and everyone in production. Designer Nina Goffey for another fabulous cover and interior layout. Map artist Jim McMahon, Jason Higgins, Stephanie Pites, Megan Lucy, Jonna Hausman, Anne-Marie Wong, Robin Hoffman, and everyone with the school channels. Alan Smegler, Elizabeth Whiting, Jackie Rubin, Alexis Lunsford, Nikki Much, Sue Flynn, Chris Satterland, Charlie Young, and everyone in sales. Lori Benton, John Pels, and Paul Gagne for their amazing work on the Grenade audiobook. And all the sales reps and fairs and clubs reps across the country who work so hard to tell the world about my books. Special thanks to the writers at Batcave who heard me talk about this story for years, most especially to my friend and fellow writer Carrie Ryan for her 11th hour critique that made a world of difference. Thanks as always to my friend Bob, and big thanks to my literary agent Holly Root at Root Literary, and to my publicists and right-hand women, Lauren Haar and Carolyn Christopoulos at Gold Leaf Literary Services. The work you do allows me to do the work I do. And thanks again to all the teachers, librarians, and booksellers out there who put my books into the hands of young readers. You're awesome. And last but never least, much love and thanks to my wife, Wendy, and my daughter, Jo.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.